So, well, this is my summary. I thought if we looked at my summary of his argument, and then we could discuss the text sort of thing, if you're happy to do that. So, we just sort of go through it, really. So, rather than... this is a briefer version from what... Some of you may not have read the Ricoeur article, but this is my summary, because it's not an easy read, I don't think. Ricoeur's not easy to read. And... but it's worth struggling with, I find. So Ricoeur offers this hypothesis that the human sciences may be said to be hermeneutical insofar as their object, which is social action or society, displays some features constitutive of a text, and their method develops the same procedures as text interpretation. So that's the argument, that's what he wants to argue. And this is a summary of how he does it in my reading.
Can I ask which human sciences?
He doesn't specify, I don't think, but I think sociology, hermeneutics would be a human science, mm-hmm. Phenomenology, philosophy, humanities.
Humanities. Yeah, humanities, okay.
And by hermeneutics, he means the rules required for the interpretation of written documents. He's very keen on the notion of written documents, and he defines text as a written... anything inscribed by writing. And his hypothesis is, if there are problems which are raised by the interpretation of texts because they are texts and not spoken language, then the human sciences may be said to be hermeneutical. One, in as much as their object displays some of the features constitutive of text, and two, in as much as their methodology develops the same kind of procedures as those of text interpretation. So that's his thesis. Therefore, two questions arise. A, to what extent is text a good paradigm for the object of the social sciences? Is social action analogous to text? And B, to what extent may we use the method of text interpretation as a paradigm for interpretation in general in the human sciences? So, hi, Naim.
Hi.
Oh, yeah, you've got another one now. Good. So we're just going through Ricoeur's argument. So that's his thesis, and that's his two questions. He then goes on to talk about discourse, the notion of discourse, and he says, first of all, discourse refers to a world. Secondly, a sentence designates its speaker in various ways, but what the text says now matters more than what the author meant to say. So what the text says to us now is more important than the author's intention, in contrast to Hirsch that we were looking at a couple of weeks ago. And thirdly, a written discourse is distinct from spoken in that it cannot be rescued by processes of intonation, gesture, etc. Dialogue ultimately refers to the situation common to the interlocutors. Therefore, in the same way that a text frees its meaning from intention, so it frees its reference from the limits of ostensive reference. So, in other words, now, if we're speaking, the meaning of what I say depends upon a lot of on intonation and gesture and waving my arms in the air and all that. Whereas a written document, you don't have any of that. You've just got the text, as it were. So it's free from ostensive reference, i.e. pointing. The written verbal discourse is always has an ostensive reference. It always points to a particular situation. Whereas a written discourse is freed from the from what Ricoeur would see as the limitations entailed by ostensive reference. Only writing frees itself from its author and the narrowness of the dialogical situation. So oral texts, oral traditions entail a dialogical situation, entail interlocutors and people speaking. A written text is freed from that. That's quite... It's like the Mimamsakas in a way, isn't it? It's freed from human... Text is free from human kind of interference through writing. So fourthly then, discourse refers to a world and is characterized by sentences which designate their speakers. by indicators of subjectivity such as personal pronouns. So I want a cup of coffee and all the rest of it. In such cases, the intention of the speaker and the meaning of what is said coincide in contrast to the meaning of a written text which goes beyond the intention of the author. So when I speak, what I mean coincides with what the words I say. Whereas in a written text, the meaning intended by the author, the text has gone beyond the meaning intended by the author. It's freed from that reference point. Written discourse is distinct from the spoken discourse, for only with written discourse is interpretation the remedy for unclarity of meaning, or the weaknesses of, or quote, the weakness of discourse which the author can no longer save. So if you're speaking and I say something and then you interpret it in a certain way, say, no, I didn't mean that at all, I meant this, but you, with a written text you don't have that possibility. In spoken discourse, this is not the case, for misunderstanding can be remedied by clarification from the speaker, through intonation, through context of speech, and so on. Spoken discourse, is therefore, has this ostensive reference, because it is only understood by speakers who are sharing a common situation. Bakhtin's very good on this. He writes on this kind of thing, speech genres. So somebody says, well, I mean, the meaning of that depends upon the context in which it's uttered. Hmm. Written discourse, by contrast, is freed from ostensive reference and is open to a much wider audience. And indeed, Richard Gombrich argues that's why Buddhism spread, because of the invention of writing. You know, Mahayana Buddhism spread through the invention of writing, because then you could write the texts. I guess it also entails people being able to read them as well. There's a certain level of education there. So it is addressed not just to a you, the second person, but to anyone who knows how to read. Yeah. Of five, only discourse, not language, is addressed by someone and is the foundation of communication. It's addressed to someone, sorry, and is the foundation of communication. Not language, because long is a sort of structure, and there's a grammatical pattern, I suppose, to language which you can analyse. But in text, the someone is anyone who knows how to read. So there's no addressivity, direct addressivity. The audience, you don't know who you're writing. Well, you have got a vague idea who you're writing for, I suppose, but anyone who knows how to read can read the text. So he then goes on to talk about text and action. Oh, hello.
Sorry, I'm late.
That's okay.
Second page.
Say that again.
Do you have another second page? Just go right ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Is there another one?
Mm-hmm.
I'll go copy.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I don't have another second page. So we just go through de Kurt's argument, and that's a summary of it. What Trivoyer is getting that second page. You're all happy with that so far? Do you? Are you convinced by de Kurt's argument?
It's quite clear so far.
Yeah.
Either him or your presentation.
I think it's de Kurt.
Yeah, and like Kristeva, I actually felt that he wants us to understand what he's writing.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
He's not just stating his ideas, but he's actually explaining them.
Yeah.
Quite good.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he's worth reading the car. There's a density to his language, which is good, but there's a clarity to it as well. And he captures your attention somehow. So my mapping doesn't correspond to his summary. It's a thing to his subheadings, but I've abstracted from what he's saying. So, okay, text and action. We've just gone through his basic ideas that text is analogous to sorry, that he's distinguished between spoken discourse and written discourse so far, and arguing that written discourse is freed from the intention of the author, of his meaning. And he's then going to go on to argue for the analogy between text and action as parallel, which is what he's doing here. So text and action in this section. To what extent can we say that the object of the human sciences conforms to the paradigm of the text? If the object of the human sciences is meaningfully oriented behaviour, as Weber says, to what extent can this be replaced by readability characters, what he calls readability characters, i.e. can we read human actions in a way parallel to the way we can read a text, a written discourse? Ricoeur thinks we can, of course. So A, action is meaningful, as meaningful may become an object of science. But an action may also have an illocutionary force. An illocutionary act is one performed by a speaker by uttering words such as promising or threatening, which can have perlocutionary consequences, that is, the effect of the illocutionary speech act, such as making someone hopeful or frightening them. So this is from Austin, was it How to Do Things with Words? Or Searle, I can't remember which one, Austin, I think, made this, talked about speech acts, his book Speech Acts. Made this distinction, but there are locutionary statements such as Caesar crossed the Rubicon, which are just meaningful in themselves, and there are illocutionary speech acts like I name this ship and you throw the thing against the side. So that's a speech act which has consequences in the world, and the perlocutionary acts are the consequences of illocutionary statements. So a perlocutionary act, illocutionary act, oh, I'm going to murder you or something, and the perlocutionary effect would be fear in the person. So if that's an analysis of action, a speech acts rather, then he's saying action is like that. Action has the structure of a locutionary act, first of all. Well, in my view, that's where Ricoeur's problematic in that, in thinking that. But we can return to that in a second. It has a propositional content, e.g., Brutus kills Caesar can be understood whether or not Brutus kills Caesar. So it's a locutionary statement, locutionary act. The noematic structure of action may become an object to interpret. So this is phenomenological language. Noema, do anyone remember what noema is?
Understanding.
Yeah, the object. Yeah, noesis is the process of understanding. Noema is the object of understanding. So it corresponds to the cogitationes and all that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So the noematic structure of action may become an object to interpret. So action is, I mean, it's just a posh way of saying that action becomes an object of inquiry. An action may be identified not only by its propositional content, Brutus kills Caesar, but by its illocutionary force, the effects of actions. Action is like a speech act. So promising, for example. What is fixed by writing, by analogy, is the noema of the speaking. So a text becomes, as an act, becomes an object of the sciences, if you like. So the text is parallel to the act, in that it can become an object, a noema. And by a parallel, what is done, which is fixed by doing, is inscribed. So as the meaning is fixed in the text, in the written discourse, so an action, once done, once written on time, if you like, cannot be undone, is always completed. And therefore it's like a text. As a text is detached from its author, so an action is detached from its agent, and develops consequences of its own. Actions have effects unintended by agents. The doer is present to his doing in the same way as the speaker is present to his speech. In simple actions, the meaning, the noema, and the intention, the noesis, coincide. But with complex actions, some segments are so remote from initial segments which express the intention of the doer that the ascription of these actions constitutes a problem parallel to that of authorship. So, sometimes, I want a cup of coffee, I go and make a cup of coffee, the meaning and the intention coincide, the noema and the noesis, the noema, the cup of coffee made, and the noesis, the intention of making a cup of coffee, coincide. But it's other complex things like raising the interest rate or something, that has consequences beyond your intention. So, they're unpredictable, you know.
Like the ECB.
Yeah, or declaring war on a country is an action which has consequences beyond.
Very good.
Making a promise, breaking a promise, all these things are actions which. Throttling someone. I didn't mean to kill her. That we had in the news the other day. Actions which exceed, the action has consequences beyond the intention of the agent. Particularly historical actions.
But can you divide those two things that clearly? I mean, even when you go up and do something like make a coffee, it has an effect on the world in a way that you might not even be aware of.
Yeah.
But you still participate in it in some way.
Mm.
So can you make that clear distinction between
these
two types of actions?
Yeah.
I mean, if I use coffee beans that have come from somewhere, maybe I'm interpreting this wrong, but if I've used coffee beans that have come from somewhere where they weren't fairly traded or something like this, my action of just making a cup of coffee has all these repercussions in the world.
Good point, yeah. Yeah.
So even though the noesis and the noema are connected in my own head, it doesn't mean that they
That's a very good example. I mean, it's not precursory. The cup of coffee was just my example, but I mean, that's a good example, the way action exceeds the boundaries of your conscious awareness, of your agency, in a way, I make a cup of coffee, but actually it's a little contribution to some poor coffee farmer in Brazil or something being oppressed or something. I suppose it's a scale of actions. If you've got a scale of text, so you have a scale of actions, really. With raising the interest rates at the kind of far end of it has consequences for a wider audience, as it were.
Yeah.
And making the coffee, which still has consequences, but less so, perhaps. And also, who for? Who does it have consequences for? But that's this is. I mean, Bakhtin's got on this. He wrote a book called Philosophy of the Act, and he talks about the answerability of action. But when you act, you can never completely be sure of the consequences of your actions.
Mm.
Never completely understand that. It's always beyond you.
Are you using answerability in the term as accountability?
Yes, accountability.
Yeah. Okay.
You're accountable for your acts. So, moving on at B, then, as a locutionary act is said, and perhaps written in a text, so action can be done, and in one sense inscribed or written on history. In the same way that a text is detached from its author and exceeds authorial intention, so an action, by virtue of being done, exceeds its agent and develops consequences of its own, which were perhaps unintended. C. Completed actions go beyond the immediate environment of their occurrence, and while actions may correspond to agents' intention, their interpretation and indeed their consequences exceed that intention. History, writes Ricoeur, is this quasi-thing on which human action leaves a trace, puts its mark. an action can exceed an ostensive reference, go beyond the social conditions of its immediate production, and, like a text, address an indefinite number of possible readers. So, I mean, Ricoeur doesn't make that distinction that I just made between kind of different kinds of action. Perhaps he does implicitly.
Can I just ask him? I'm kind of baffled by his distinction between a spoken and written discourse, and between action because spoken discourse is an action. And so here, before he basically says that that spoken discourse is constrained by these ostensive references, whether he says that action is now freed, goes beyond these references. Isn't that a contradiction?
That's a good point. Yeah. So the spoken discourse is constrained by ostensive reference.
Whereas
an action isn't, but yet an action must be constrained by.
Yeah, because spoken discourse is an action.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm confused by, because as he sort of makes this this parallel between the something that is said, which can then be written, and an action that can then be sort of inscribed in history, but isn't every action, as soon as it's done, is that sort of inscribed in history?
Mm-hmm.
So is he really making that sort of
that
parallel?
Yeah.
Or does he mean only certain big actions, like going to war, making a cup of coffee is not inscribed in history? Or
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've taken it to be that, in a way, that he's talking about. That's
only significant.
Significant actions, but then who's to say what significant actions?
Exactly.
I suppose history.
History tells us.
Who's history?
Yes, who's history?
But a whole lot of small actions may be a significant action overall. I mean, there could be millions of people doing one little action, as you were suggesting.
Yeah.
Which can have huge consequences.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So that's a good point, that there's an implicit contradiction between his notion of discourse and action. Discourse is spoken discourse, which is constrained by situation, and he's saying action is freed. It frees itself from ostensive reference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's actually trying to make a parallel between action and written text, not spoken. He's distinguishing. So he's got spoken text, if you want, discourse on the one hand, which is speech, and on the other hand, he's got written discourse, and it's written discourse which is like action. But you're right, why can't action be more like spoken discourse? Because spoken discourse is an action.
Yeah.
Is an action.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a very good point.
He does say that somewhere.
Does he say that somewhere?
I missed it.
But writing a text is also an action.
Yeah.
But
once it's freed from writing, it's gone beyond. It's beyond my power, control.
But unlike action, it's sort of contained. You know, it places some kind of finite boundaries on time by being a product, by being a book or something like this, by being a text.
Yeah.
Whereas action doesn't really have that privilege. It always seems to be in the flow of time. You can't say, okay, this action ended now and contain it, whereas a text is always, you know, it has
beginning
to be
and
contained
an end. Yeah.
but it may also be the start of a beginning. The text itself may have huge implications moving forward.
Yeah, well, it may be a text in the process of
what?
Text,
I mean, it's huge over history.
It's necessarily contained by being in the form of a text.
Yeah. But by being inscribed in writing, it has a beginning and an end. I think that's what Ricoeur is saying.
No.
But you're right, in the sense that the consequences go beyond the actual written text. But with regard to action, I think he's... The parallel between action and text is problematic, it seems to me. Because the way you draw the line between one action and the next action, how do you contain the notion of an action? Things have beginnings and ends. So, he says, the action is an action as an object is made possible by inner traits of action, which are similar to the structure of speech acts.
But is action an object?
Is action an object? He says it is an object. See, and it's the object of the social sciences. What does social science study? It studies human actions.
So in order to be an object, it needs to be contained in some way and differentiated from other actions.
He has to maintain that. Yeah. The meaning of an action can be detached from the event of an action. So the event of an action, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, the meaning of that, you might not know at the time. The meaning of it only becomes clear through the progress of history. That's a fair point, I suppose. But there is a problem of containing actions. How do you contain an action? He then goes on about... He starts to talk about history. This is interesting, this article, because it's he develops lots of these themes later on. History is a record of human action, a quasi-thing in which human action leaves a trace. And archives, he says, are intentionally written down, and there is a process of recording action. Human actions over time lose connection with intention of actors. Meaning resides in the work itself, which is the object of the social sciences, is rule-governed behaviour. You know, this Winch goes on about it. A meaningful action is an action, and the importance of which goes beyond its relevance to its initial situation. But I think that's a fair point. Perhaps he labours it a bit. This parallels ways in which the text breaks ties of discourse to all of ostensive reference. Freed from its situational context, discourse can develop non-ostensive reference, which we call a world. The creation of world corresponds in the field of action to the non-extensive reference of a text. Non-extensive reference. Non-ostensive, that should be.
Ostensive.
I think that should be rather than extensive. I don't know what I mean. Well, that's... Yeah. Well, he's already made this point, isn't he, really? So that's the claim, and we've pointed out two difficulties with it already. One is why is action like a written text and not like discourse? One would have thought intuitively, as the way I was saying, that an action is like a discourse more, because when we speak, it's an action. And the other one is, where do you draw the boundaries around an action? Very good point. Where does one action end and the next begin? I suppose you could say, well, actually, you arbitrarily demarcate certain segments of time and you call that one action, action one. But there's fuzzy edges, isn't there? Making a cup of coffee, there's a fuzzy edge between when you get up from the chair and make the coffee. Then when does it end? Does it... I guess when it's you'd have to wait when you're drinking smelling the aroma. Is that when the text, the action is finished?
Yeah. I guess the action is not as stable as texts are. And especially when he goes on and explaining this hermeneutic circle and all that. I mean, when you have text in front of you, so you can really go these processes of explanation, interpretation, and circle around. But when you have an action, I mean, you need to translate it first into text in order to go through hermeneutic circle. Otherwise, I don't know how you can do it. I mean,
because it gets forgotten, doesn't it?
I mean, like an anthropologist in the field, you know, you are observing a certain action. How are you going to apply all that before you actually translate that situation into text? I just
don't see. You create the text by writing the field notes and then you interpret the field notes, so you're interpreting the text.
Which is different thing from action.
But in several places he seems to imply that he's really talking not just about action because that would be more or less the correspond, you know, the corresponding thing would be, you know, the spoken, a spoken text, you know, mm-hmm. But actually actions that are inscribed in time, which kind of, and at some places he even hints at that means, you know, they're in the past, and mm-hmm. only then mm-hmm. they're a text. And so certain actions, you know, you making a cup of coffee has not left a mark on history.
No.
But, you know, the, you know, country going to war or you know, me assassinating a president or something, that would leave a mark in history. But I'm not sure that's what he's saying, but that's the impression I got.
Mm-hmm. That's the impression I get too.
And then that becomes mm-hmm. the sort of analogous to text, because it is already removed from its the agent of the action and so on as a text. Is
mm-hmm. But they are already text. These actions, aren't they, from the past?
I mean,
they
are in history.
Yeah, because they are written somewhere, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how else?
Well, he would say the actual action of, say, Caesar crossing the Rubicon. That's an action. It gets inscribed as a text,
mm-hmm.
but the consequences of that
mm-hmm.
Go beyond the action itself, whether mm-hmm. it's written or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the, I don't even know where the Rubicon is.
That's a game, isn't it?
Yeah.
But apparently it had effects on history beyond my comprehension. Well, take the Norman Conquest as an action
mm-hmm.
that we know about through the Bayeux Tapestry and so mm-hmm. on. But I mean, it was an action that had consequence beyond its the act mm-hmm. itself, whether we know.
Huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I suppose it's like if I go and sit in a bathtub, then that's not a significant action. But if, you know, some Greek person in the past,
Archimedes, was it?
Yeah.
Shouts out Eureka.
Yeah.
And suddenly that is a significant act that is inscribed in mm-hmm. time. And,
Yeah, I guess then the conclusion is that this model is perhaps good to analyze certain aspects of human sciences, but not all.
Mm.
Like, if you're more into research of sitting in a bathtub and similar actions, you know, like, so some social sciences are more like hands-on than really some historical event, then this is probably not good, right?
Even sociology or anthropology, you've got actions. Are actions like texts?
I mean, there is this crucial example of this problem in anthropology, because it comes down through Geertz, you know, culture as texts, and basically the criticism is that by treating culture as text, or because culture is actions, right? That you basically treat culture as a spectacle, and you don't attend to the meanings that go beyond what you have seen,
mm-hmm.
right? You just, you know, it's a performance. And a very good example of that is how action is basically not a text, and how this is very problematic in understanding culture is the Tully River people. These are aborigines in Australia, and when they saw white men handling pieces of paper with the text, and they were puzzled by it, and in order to, you know, to understand what is it, they took this piece of paper and they didn't put in front of their eyes, but in front of their ears. So for them, they have no concept of understanding, you know, that information is transmitted through visual terms in the way we are doing it.
It is oral, right?
Yes.
That's how they understand information. You know,
this culture is definitely not a text.
Yeah.
You know, it's more probably, it would be better to say that it is a sound, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, these are kind of problems.
Yeah. But there you've got the aborigine listening to the sheet of A4 is that's an action that becomes an object of human sciences, though, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? Becomes the object of the anthropologist's discourse.
Mm-hmm.
So you write sort of
But you analyze the report. But this whole approach to this culture as a text to their action as a text is actually is problematic, because this is not how they see it. So if you want to understand their culture and to say that and approach it from the paradigm that it is a text is wrong.
That's right.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah. It's one of the problems with postmodernism too. I mean, like Derrida or somebody was in Yapador text or something. There's nothing outside the text.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But it's. I mean, you get a life, of course. I mean, most of life is outside of text in a way. Most of action is outside of text, it seems to me.
Well, to speak of cultures like that, that really is speaking.
Indeed.
Yeah. What about non-verbal communication? What you know?
Well, that's ostensive reference.
Yeah.
Which Ricoeur says, once you've written it down, it's freed from that.
But like, he doesn't sort of seem to account for oral text. Like, you know, say the Veda for Vedic Brahmins, it's not a text that's written down, but it's a text that was preserved in recitation. And so is that merely a spoken text, as a spoken utterance, or is it actually, you know, does it have more characteristics of a written text?
Indeed.
And he sort of seems to just dismiss that as being purely similar to me saying I'm going to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, he does. I agree. Because he would say that oral text, now Budri Brahmin is reciting the Veda, is still restricted by ostensive reference. It's not freed from the situation in which it's recited, which is true in a way, because I mean,
in another way, at least according to that example of the Brahmins, they're so restricted by intonation, and there's no question of adding anything, because it's just so precise, right? So in one way it's just as etched in stone as ink on paper.
That's true. It is. It's fixed by, it's actually not fixed in writing, but fixed in speech. But he would say it's more limited, because once all those people die out, then the text is gone. Whereas if it's written in a book, till some meteor hits the earth, it's still still there. I don't know what he'd say to that. I think he probably doesn't really know much about that, to be honest. He just lived in Paris, isn't he?
And I was thinking also about, you know, the text as freed from the context and open to everything, to inscription of meaning. I think that in many ways text really doesn't exist separate from reading of the text. And the reading of the text is always contextual, so you cannot really...
That's a very good point.
You know, you cannot really say that text is free, completely freed from, you know, that you can take the text and, you know, what you have infinite number of, all the possibilities that are ingrained in text are available to you. I don't think that this is true. You are constrained by yourself, by the situation, by the atmosphere, you know, by the purpose.
Although we can accept with Ricoeur that the text is freed from the intention of the author, it's not free from ostensive reference because of the community of reception. That's very interesting. And in a similar way, action. It's not freed in the.
I didn't understand your point actually.
The act of reading the text is not freed from ostensive references. From the context in which you are reading. You know, yourself.
Yeah.
Your purpose while you are reading, and so, I mean. In some ways, text doesn't really exist apart from the reading it, you can say. You know, it is written somewhere, but...
That's next week, so that's right.
What does it?
I mean, it's there, but, you know, what does it mean if it's not read? You know what I mean?
It's brought into, like, this space and time, and this space and time has an impact upon it.
I think that's... I sort of agree with that, I think.
But if you're interpreting action, the same is true, no?
Mm-hmm.
Revisit anything.
I mean, yeah, I think that what you said, the action, I think the problematic is this divorce of action from the agent also. You know, you can say that, you know, this Caesar crossing Rubicon has consequences that are beyond the intention of the Caesar, of course, but I don't think that, you know, that looking at action as divorced from agent completely is a way.
It's not useful.
Yeah. I think it's misleading. I mean, it can be useful maybe partly, or you know, especially for these long gone actions and
because action's linked to purpose, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's linked to intentions, reasons why.
Yeah,
why you do certain things.
I guess just my opinion is that
there are some actions, so like play, which doesn't have purpose.
Something like that. Yeah.
I accepted this interpretation because I've read in a different way. Uh-huh. For example, in a tradition where the text has so much authority and power, like Protestantism, the text is everything. In the case, action, for example, communal action as a ritual or worship or all these things, sacrament, can be the object of interpretation if we accept because hermeneutics. Otherwise, the text, the Bible, only has the supreme authority. But if we follow, if we accept because proposal, then the whole living experience of the religious community can be the text we can interpret.
Ah, that's a nice way of looking at it, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the whole, the religious community itself, the action of the of this community of people, of a church or whatever, becomes analogous to the text.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a broadening of the notion of text. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's, within that context, there's a it's too restricted. You get a biblical, you get a Bartian word, and that's it. Divorce from a community of reception. But if you accept Ricoeur's argument, then you have the action of the community of reception can be read in a way parallel to the text. Is that...
Yes,
is
it, or the ritual or other things can be a text.
Yeah, the ritual can be a text, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
So it comes down that it works for historical experience for on the level of history, but it's not quite good on the perhaps on the individual and more mundane level.
What about the inscription in ritual of the text in the community, say? On the body, the textualization.
That was your thing, wasn't it?
I'm connected up with this, but this methodology of interpretation. Let me just finish this, and then we can have another 5 minutes talking about it. This approach of action as text offers a new interpretation of relation between understanding and explanation. That's that big thing that Dilthey highlighted. So. Well, we can talk about that in a minute. The paradigm of reading provides a solution to the methodological paradox of the human sciences, i.e., if there is a gap between explanation and understanding, how can the human sciences be scientific at all? So, if you have a hermeneutics, he argues, collapses the distance between explanation and understanding, because hermeneutics is both explanation and understanding. If explanation is what's explanation? I suppose I've always understood explanation to be the location of a cause, whereas understanding isn't about causes. And four traits, he said, constitute the objectivity of the text: the fixation of meaning, or the fixing of meaning, I suppose; the dissociation from the mental intention of the author; the display of non-ostensive reference; and the universal range of a address.
Addressees.
Which, yeah, we've already gone over that, I think. And the importance of the art of guessing. Guesses can be validated. Dialectic from explanation to comprehension and vice versa, he goes on about. And it's not true that all interpretations are equal, as the text is a limited field of possible constructions. Explanation requires understanding, and there are two different stages. He said the structural analysis is a stage between naive interpretation and depth interpretation, and explanation and understanding are two different stages of the hermeneutical arc. And then he says this structural model may be extended beyond text to all social phenomena. So you can talk about structures of action. And I guess he's writing at a time when that whole anthropological structuralism is kind of coming up, you know. So you get Levi Strauss and all that, looking at the structural model of social action. So we've heard, on the one hand, we've heard kind of arguments against Ricoeur's identification of text with action, and on the other, we've heard an argument in support of it in the example of ritual, for example, where ritual is a kind of action that is more analogous to text than other kinds of action, perhaps. So I think that's a really good point. So I think we're all in agreement that action exceeds, actions can exceed the tensions of the agent in a way that the meaning of a text can exceed the intentions of its author. But you could argue that that's where the analogy doesn't go much beyond that, and that written text, either the thing we just read by Ricoeur, is quite different from an action. Like, failing everyone's exams or something would be an action which have very negative consequences for everyone involved, including the marker, you know. But that's not like a text, is it? So the text is only by analogy. I mean, Ricoeur, it seems, he's arguing it's analogy, but he wants a stronger connection than it's not merely analogy, he's arguing. It's something like the very nature of the world, which is like a text.
So there are limits to that analogy, and I think that there are limits when we face individual, probably, and more less historical, should I say, action, less ritual.
So if we say that, then there are implications for the methodology in the social sciences. So he wants to pull in scientific method closer to text interpretation as being hermeneutical, where some objective sociologists wouldn't want to do that. So one of the reasons, I think, for writing this would be to what extent is it justified in the human sciences or social sciences being understood as hermeneutical, interpretative? And he says, one way we can justify our procedures is by analysing the relationship between text and action. Actions are like texts. Therefore, they can be interpreted like texts. Therefore, interpretation is a valid way of going about social sciences.
But it seems to me like a stronger claim to say that it's like text than to say it might be seen as language and therefore linguistic tools could be applied to its interpretation. I think.
Yeah.
So it seems like that's what he's writing in the community of structuralism, which is perhaps saying, okay, we can use these linguistic tools to interpret all these different spheres of reality, but then to say, therefore, action and all these other domains are like text is takes it too far, somehow. And so it does. By disagreeing with him that text and action are so correspondent, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can't use the linguistic tools in order to interpret.
Oh yes,
I think
yeah. It's
not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, basically.
So we could still use hermeneutical tools, if you like,
to
look at social action without the stronger claim that social action is like a text.
Yeah.
Especially because you always end up with a text in the end, you know, any account of any social action.
Yeah.
You know, if it's scientific, academic, it's a text.
Indeed.
It seems also to be, particularly towards the end, sort of comes out that one of his interests in applying this all this hermeneutics and the idea of the text on action is to sort of argue that the social sciences are in a way scientific too, and that there is a way in which you can come to a certain understanding of these things.
Yeah.
It's not sort of everything goes, and he sort of brings us up in the final section of this chapter.
Right. The last few pages, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So what bottom page 217?
Sorry?
Does he talk about that?
Yeah, the one bit. Start at the beginning.
What about 217?
Nobody knows.
It's a good place to start.
On my version, I don't know what version.
Nobody knows it.
Yeah, he talks about structural analysis.
Mm.
So what's he saying here? So the function of structural analysis is to lead from a surface semantics, that of the narrated myth, to a depth semantics, that of the boundary situations which constitute the ultimate reference of the myth. He's raising that as a question, but I think that's what he's saying. Now, I really believe that if such were not the function of structural analysis, it would be reduced to a sterile game, a divisive algebra. And even the myth would be bereaved of the function which Levi-Strauss himself assigns to it, that of making men aware of certain oppositions and of tending towards their progressive mediation. So he wants, he thinks that social sciences, because of structuralism in a way, can be more objectively scientific. Yeah. And that they're both explanations and interpretations, and that you can't separate explanation from interpretation.
I guess, I mean, now it's the question of what is the aim of the social sciences. You know, I guess there are different disciplines that have different aims here. So, you know, if a aim is a representation of a culture, then this might be lacking. Right, because you are going to surely miss a lot if you go out in the field and treat the culture as a text, you know, treat only what has been presented to you and what you can transfer to text. You're going to miss out how these people feel, what was going on in the back of the scenes that you kind of sensed or just guessed. And, you know, and it seems to me that the meaning of the culture is more in all that what is going behind than what is really represented and what you interpreted from this representation. You know, there are many anthropologists who have actually done this mistake and been criticized by that. Here's the first one with the Balinese cockfight, you know, where he actually sees stuff that is not actually there in the end. So I guess it just works for parts of the social sciences, maybe history or philology or something.
Looking at social looking at action as a text can actually be distorting and limiting.
Yeah. Because in the end it's only analogy. Culture is really not a text, and action is not.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's good.
But I mean, it could be analogous with the text in that you could look at a kind of a field work situation and say it's somehow rule governed. There's some framework beyond it, which to me is like a text. There is something which is being expressed. There is some structure which is somehow coming out in the everyday sort of seemingly disparate lives of people. And if you were somehow able to understand the framework and the rules of it, then you would have some kind of code in order to interpret the whole. And I suppose this kind of analogy might work, because you're going back to this synchronic sort of idea that there is rules that will transcend the sort of space-time dimension somehow.
Yeah, so to understand social action, in fact, to Winchell, you have to understand what it is to follow a rule. Yeah, I agree with that.
But it's, at the same time, you need to allow it not to be a text. You need to allow it to be...
Yeah.
But then you have to somehow jump between this diachronic analysis and the synchronic, bear the two in mind at the same moment in order to really grasp something.
Yeah. very, very interesting. It's interesting, isn't it? Oh, this is an action, isn't it? I mean, sitting around a table talking about Ricoeur is an action. Which we all know how to follow a rule, don't we? To do this, we have to follow a rule. I mean, no one's cracking open cans of beer, are they? And kind of, you know, dancing on the table or anything. So there are kind of, you know, constraints of the situation.
We can try that.
Which get, I mean, so office parties and sort of Christmas, you know, those things get upset and challenged. Thanks, everyone. We've got to stop this. This is a shame. This is very interesting. So.